Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Interesting moments we've had this year as On Point has grappled with this news. In September, as war on Iraq talk grew, we had on the show James Woolsey, former director of the CIA, now one of Washington's most prominent hawks. He wants to see the U.S. military used to lead the way in an effort to redraw the map of the Arab world, and he's not alone in this in Washington, D.C. I asked former CIA chief James Woolsey if the urge to democratize the Arab world by force amounts to American imperialism.
It's certainly not imperialism. We're not trying to take anybody's land. The only land I think we've ever asked for in any of the three world wars of the 20th century, two hot and one cold, is enough to bury our dead in Normandy. We aren't trying to impose our system on anybody. What we are doing is, I think, following the British, and long before that, in a sense, the Romans, in carrying forth an ideal of government being responsive to the people that really originally was Athenian. But this idea has, in the last 88 years, gone a long way toward taking over the central thesis of how government should proceed in the world. We're not going to impose any tributes on any of these countries. We're not going to ask for any land. All we really want is for them to be able to live in peace and freedom. And we've done a fair amount in the last 88 years to bring the world in that direction, but there's still more to do, and much of it is in the Mideast.
Still more to do, much of it in the Middle East. There's former CIA chief James Woolsey saying, let's use American power to redraw the map of the Middle East, to democratize the Middle East. I'm joined this hour by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack. Are you there?
Hello, Tom. Yes, I am.
So you hear our former CIA chief, and he's part of what Nick Lemon at The New Yorker and a frequent guest here calls the jaunty view in Washington that says, we've got this power. Let's go in and use it to remake the world.
Yes, he's got his jodhpurs ready. He's going to plunge in there. And notice the slip in what he says. He says, we're not imperialists, and then he refers to the British and the Romans. You know, we haven't still come back from Germany. We're still in Japan. We're still in Korea. We're still in Bosnia. And each year we pay for these things. He's not mentioning that. We don't tend to come home after wars from places where we fight.
Of course, there's a view out there that perhaps there are some in Washington who do not want to come home after this war any too quickly, that Iraq, with its position, with its importance, with its potential threat of weapons of mass destruction, needs some policing. Also, with its oil, may need some pumping. We had James Fallows on in September. National correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly has reported from all over the world, an old friend of mine, discussing what needs to happen after a war in Iraq. The scope of the challenge there, James Fallows talked about Iraq as the 51st state. I asked him how Washington is imagining the war and post-war Iraq.
One reason why the military generally is much more reluctant about this war than are the political leaders is the military has been sort of conditioned to think about what are the unintended, unimagined consequences of combat. You know, strangely, in the time since Vietnam, we've sort of over-imagined the risks of combat itself, and I think come to under-imagine the consequences in the long term. If you could sort of magically assassinate Saddam Hussein and his dozen most important henchmen by a ninja squad, and just not do any other damage except to the intended leaders, then maybe you could just walk away and say, not our problem anymore. But realistically, by the time you destroy him, either you will have bombarded the country, killing lots of people, or you will have had some tens of thousands of men and thousands of tanks rolling in there. There's going to be a whole lot of damage that we will have done and the Iraqi army will have done by the time the fighting is over, even if it's only a week or 2 weeks. There are going to be a lot of people killed.
We've made rubble before and not stuck around to rebuild. Why here?
Not on this scale, not preemptively, and not unilaterally.
James Fallows in September On Point, and there, Jack Beattie, we have kind of the twin pillars of the views of this war. The James Woolsey view, let's get in there and do the necessary. This is a dangerous country. We can remake it with American power. The James Fallows warning, it is hard to imagine the far side of war, what the consequences, what the long tail may be.
Indeed, and just on the financial side, I mean, the Pentagon was off by 90% in its estimate of what the Vietnam War would cost. The North was off by 13 times what it thought the Civil War would cost. the cash way of looking at it is crude, but I've seen estimates of a 10-year occupation costing upwards of $500 billion.
That's a lot of money, and as James Fallow says, could make Iraq almost the 51st state. On the other hand, you get the feeling that some in Washington may actually embrace this idea to bring it under control, to take it out of the axis of evil category, to make it less of a threat. The threat that we've seen around the world has most often this year been described as the threat of terror. In October, Gary Hart joined us. Now his name is being bruited about as a potential presidential candidate in the upcoming race on the Democratic side. But the former senator, Gary Hart, was co-chair of the Independence Task Force that assessed U.S. domestic preparedness. 1 year after 9/11, they concluded that America is not prepared for another terrorist attack and that there are gaping holes in homeland security. Gary Hart zeroed in with us on the private sector. I asked him if the private sector needs to take more responsibility for domestic security and why.
Something called the critical infrastructure primarily, and those are the core industries upon which our society and our nation and our economy are based. And 80 to 90% of those systems, and they are big systems, mm-hmm. are in private hands. Well, the President of the United States has to call those executives into his office and say, ladies and gentlemen, this country expects you to do your duty as American citizens and protect your plants. Now, if anybody's got a problem with that, I want to hear it right now.
Well, it seems like they are voicing a problem with it, as you say,
well,
through lobbyists.
Well, they're doing it behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure they're all out giving speeches to chambers of commerce saying what great American citizens they are, while they're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to Washington lobbyists to kill this legislation.
What's really going on there? Is it a kind of game of chicken where they want the government to come in and protect their industry?
Asking me to tell you about their motives. Ask them. It's about the bottom line. It's about profits. It costs money to build higher fences and to hire more guards and put brighter lights on the perimeters. So if you're out to make money, you're probably not going to want to do that.
Gary Hart, former senator, October 31st on Point. Jack Beatty, here he is peeling away another layer of the onion skin of terror. There are a lot of layers here. Gary Hart saying it's not as simple as you may think. The whole issue of what the private sector is doing on the terror front has scarcely been addressed, at least scarcely in public.
It's true. Senator Byrd was one of the few people who did so. He said that instead of this, if we took the money it's going to cost and the opportunity cost it's going to involve of the Homeland Security Department and put it into, tax credits and helping companies out that can't afford it, we could really do something for our security. An estimate in the paper the other day, one dirty bomb in one container in the city of Chicago, a hit on the economy, given everything, $60 billion.
And yet Gary Hart is saying we have barely begun to address the costs here, that the private sector is not making those fences higher around nuclear plants, around chemical plants, around critical infrastructure, as he calls it, an issue that we may see a lot more of and on in the year ahead. The war on terror was really consuming, but of course what has often seemed to be ground zero, not the American ground zero, but the other ground zero of terror, has been in Israel, in the occupied territories. In March this year, we had two Israeli and two Palestinian parents of what's called the parent circle here in the studio with me. All four had lost children to the conflict there. One of them was Merit Elhana Peled. She was a member of the parent circle. I asked her, an Israeli mother, to describe how her daughter fell victim to the violence.
She went downtown to buy some school books. It was just the beginning of school, the 4th of September. And there were two bombers there, two suicide bombers there, and they both took five little girls.
How did you learn the news?
Oh, a friend of my son's called me and said that he saw her going into this walk downtown, and there was an explosion. And next thing, I saw her on a stretcher in the CNN.
Was it an immediate response to think of peace, or did you first think of revenge?
I don't think that the dichotomy of forgiveness versus revenge is right. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is forgiveness. You don't forgive. We have a very strong line by a poet named Bialik, who said that even Satan has not yet invented the revenge for the blood of a child. Mm. And this is not because Satan has no means. Mm-hmm. It's because after the death of a child, the only thing that you want to do is to protect the child. And since you cannot protect your own child, you want to protect all other children. I don't think that any mother would be satisfied to see any other mother's child dead. So there's no forgiveness, but there is no revenge. The only thing that drives me is this forever unsatisfied need to protect my child and any other child.
No forgiveness, but no revenge from an Israeli mother who lost her daughter to the violence in Israel between Israelis and Palestinians. And Jack, you heard her say, how did she learn her daughter had died? I saw her on a stretcher on CNN. This conflict has been broadcast all over the world, and especially the Arab world in the last year, and it is inflammatory.
It is, and it's brutalizing the hearts of so many people, but not this woman. It's just moving and elevating to hear her generalize her suffering, to see it as a way of reaching out to other mothers to stop this abyss of blood before it swallows more innocents like her daughter.
Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a lot to talk about this hour of the year that we've just come through on Point. We'll be right back to you. I'm joined now in the studio by WBUR News Director Sam Fleming and Assistant Program Director Peter Laidotes. Peter, Sam, welcome to On Point.
Hey. Hi,
it's
Tom.
It's great to be here, Tom.
It's great to have both of you with us. We know very well, and our listeners know from what they've heard all day long for the past 2 days now, that we are in the fundraising season. You hate to come back to it, but we've got to come back to it because it makes this possible.
It does. And I have to say, Tom, I'm proud to be here. I mean, hearing these elements, I'm reminded of just how often over the past year, week after week, day after day, hour after hour, you hear unique things on Point. You take issues, you take subjects, and you probe, and you pull, and you probe, and you try to remove that layer of the onion, as we often talk about in journalism. And I think that somehow we have created this program where we get unique things out of very wise and interesting people. Sometimes they're officials like James Woolsey. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're unique like that mother talking about the fact that you can never get a revenge for the death of a child.
It just tears your heart in half. But at the same time, the illumination there is so great.
It's just so powerful. And so it's humanism, and it's trying to understand what it is that these issues that are facing us as a society, as a country, what they might mean. And we try to illuminate a little bit. I think you've become very, very good at that. And I know it's a very important thing for the people listening who tune in night after night.
It's a unique program. You only get it here on WBUR. And it's only possible through pledges from listeners just like you. When you call 1-800-909-9287, how important is your pledge? We only get 8% from the government. We get half from listeners just like you. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call to pledge for On Point.
You know, on the one hand, it feels awkward to come with our hand out. On the other hand, in some sense, to me, it doesn't, because we feel so strongly sitting in this studio, the community that we have with our listeners. In Boston, across the country, it's a powerful community of people tuning in night after night, and we hear from them. Their calls really make this show. They take us to the heart of what's going on. This show is breaking new ground for public radio. It's the first major live evening news program in public radio history, as far as I know.
No, it definitely is, Tom. And I think it's breaking new ground in other ways as well. Jack, sitting up there in Hanover, New Hampshire, I presume. And
the greatest. Jack.
Yeah. And Jack, your analysis is just absolutely wonderful. So often the news calls for that. And Tom asks the questions that need to be asked to get at those issues that perhaps aren't in the headline that morning, although they might be. And I think a timely conversation about issues that people are thinking about. That's what I think of.
What's it worth to you? What is a program like this worth to you? How about $5 a month? That's a $60 pledge. Call 1-800-909-9287. Help keep programs like On Point strong and there for you.
There's a great team that works behind the scenes here to make all this happen that allows On Point to turn on a dime, to grab that headline, as Sam says, right out of the morning paper. And that same evening to have major players around that issue on the air talking to and with you, our listeners. We're really proud to let that happen, to be able to make that happen. But it's you who have built the tent with your contributions that draws in all these folks and lets us talk with them and you to join the conversation.
And I think it also we get people like Gary Hart and James Woolsey to talk to us and to come back, Nick Lemon, to come back on the program, because thoughtful conversation just doesn't happen that much. And you talked about it's unique in public radio. Well, public radio now is unique in journalism, broadcast journalism, especially in this day and age where there are not programs that allow for the kind of time and questions.
And it has been an incredible cavalcade of threads, of events. A major one has been the meltdown of trust in American corporations and the beginnings, the slow beginnings of a rebuilding. In October, we had Arthur Levitt on, former head of the SEC. And, of course, the SEC has been buffeted right and left. In a year that saw billion-dollar-sized scandals at Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, others, the SEC took a lot of heat for failing to set things right. We asked Arthur Levitt what needed to happen in the American business world.
I think we have a systemic problem resulting from an almost two-decade-long erosion of ethical values, not just on the part of the brokerage industry, but on the part of corporate America. I mean, look at the kinds of executives that we revered and put on the covers of magazines, the muscular executives who were, at a stroke of a pen, bought companies, another stroke, sold them, and then fired 10,000 people and smiled and said this was in the interests of profits. Well, that's an era gone and dead as far as I'm concerned, because the CEOs that will survive in this terrible environment will be very different from those tough guy, muscular CEOs.
In a nutshell, do you think we've taken a blow serious enough to wake the company up, to make the country up, to make the kinds of changes we need in our financial system, in Wall Street, and corporate governance?
I think humiliation and embarrassment has changed the culture in America's boardrooms. But I still think the congressional support for fundraising corporate executives and lobbyists is profoundly influential. And until that breaks up or diminishes, I think investors cannot have true trust in the system.
Former SEC Chief Arthur Levitt on point. Jack Beatty, he says humiliation and embarrassment are enormous, but so is the power of corporate money to influence the way the government works and what it asks of them.
Yeah, and doesn't he know it? I mean, when he was chairman of the SEC, he tried to pass some reforms that might have prevented these sorts of things at Enron, and he was defeated by massive lobbying led by Senator Lieberman of Connecticut, who, of course, was one of the first people to denounce these corporate malfeasance as well. He disarmed the SEC in its effort to try to deal with them.
And imagine what it would have taken to imagine a year like this, where the very foundations of the American corporate world were being so shaken, the questions were going so deep. As he said, the humiliation was going so deep. We are still not out of those woods.
We're not, and it's sobering. We did another show where we pointed out how many companies were still doing some of the same things in terms of their auditing and their consulting, and that got Enron and the rest in trouble, that there hadn't been any very widespread change at all in that fundamental behavior.
We have followed these continuing stories, and we will continue to do that, but we stand ready, just poised every day to jump on the news when it happens. The news is sometimes sad. In October, Senator Paul Wellstone's airplane crashed, northern Minnesota, down it went, and with that went a much-loved liberal senator, even among people who were not liberals, because of his candor, because of his frankness. It's something that we related to at that level, if no other, and there were others. We talked that night with Roy Groh, a professor and former colleague of Wellstone's at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. To get behind the news headlines, I asked Roy Groh how he remembered the night back in 1990 when Paul Wellstone first announced his candidacy against then-incumbent Rudy Bauschwitz.
We didn't believe him. We knew of his energy. We knew of his brightness. But the one thing that we knew always about Paul was that he was not afraid. That he wasn't afraid to tilt the giants, he wasn't afraid to take on big interests here in Minnesota, and he wasn't afraid to think of doing the impossible. I remember the night that he declared. We went up to the cities and watched him declare his candidacy in this old rundown high school. And to all of us, it looked like Don Quixote. And I think gradually, maybe even before people in the media, we began to see where he was drawing his strength. And he was flying under the radar. He had decades of students, and he had decades of standing on farm lines and people who were about to be foreclosed and people who were in trouble. And he touched those people, and they came out for him.
How will you remember Paul Wellstone Rygro?
I'm going to remember him as a real person, as a person who wasn't afraid either at Carlton to tilt the windmills or in the state of Minnesota, or more importantly, at the national level. One of the most fitting things that I heard was that he may have been a short man, but he sure leaves a big hole.
The beauty and privilege of this microphone, and you know it too, Jack, is to be ready to hold up those people and events that shed light on the world we're living in. That was a day around Paul Wellstone's death where we were able to do that.
It certainly was, and we've heard about his life. We heard about how he got started in that 1990 race with a $1,000 contribution from his wife, who's a librarian. We heard in that program that he's the only person in the U.S. Senate today for whom that job represented a raise. And doesn't that say volumes about the distance our senators are from ordinary people?
That day also said a lot to me about what it takes to put on a show like this, because it happened in the midst of the day. It's a big country. There are 280 million people. We were scrambling to find the people who could most effectively and in a heartfelt way speak to us, speak to this, to our audience, to our listeners, about what this man meant. I'm proud also to work with the producers who can go out and bring in that kind of show on that short turnaround. It's a humbling and beautiful thing, and it's a privilege to do it on that day for Paul Wellstone, but it says a lot about what the show does, what it tries to do night after night. The midterm elections were an enormous story this year and a testament to President Bush's drawing power around the country as he barnstormed coast to coast. The night of those elections, we had on Bill Schneider, veteran political analyst, knows the system inside and out. I asked Bill Schneider how the GOP managed to pull off such a stunning political victory.
What seemed to be behind it was the enthusiasm of Republicans. George Bush's campaign, which took him to 40 states in the weeks before the election, drove up the enthusiasm of Republicans.
So how much do you attribute to George Bush, and how much do you attribute to circumstances?
Oh, I attribute a lot to George Bush. I think this was basically a referendum in which Bush was the central figure. He rallied the Republican Party. They adore George Bush, but Democrats don't hate George Bush the way, say, Republicans once hated Bill Clinton. So the risk was always that by traveling around, he would drive up Democratic turnout against him. But that didn't really happen.
What is it in the character, in what this president communicates, do you think, Bill Schneider, that attracts that swooning Republican response and the grudging respect of Democrats?
Well, you said the word, character. And that's protected him mightily. Even though we have this corporate abuse scandal, even though this administration is filled with corporate CEOs more than any other administration, two energy executives at the top from Texas, Bush and Cheney, so about four CEOs in the cabinet, you'd think that the corporate responsibility scandal would have just blown them out of the water. But it didn't. And that's largely attributable to the fact that people don't really have doubts about Bush's personal integrity.
Bill Schneider on point on midterm election night, talking about the character of George Bush. And Jack, I see this as a real theme from front to back in this year, the way in which that Bush character, for all the jibes and jokes that he suffered on the campaign trail, that Bush character is coming to define the American way of thinking about the world in this year.
There's no question but that 9/11 presidentialized Mr. Bush. If we remember that summer, he was not doing very well. Some of the seams in his coalition were showing, the favoritism toward big business especially. All that seems to have been put into the shade. It's still going on, of course, but people are just sort of, I think people are projecting their hopes that the country is going to get through this on Mr. Bush, and that what they're protecting in admiring him is in a way their own fears about the future.
It's fascinating watching those fears and hopes sitting in this seat, wanting to respect both the fears and the hopes, because people do see a kind of optimism and comfort there, and yet at the same time feeling like it's our job to put the crowbar in a little bit, to put the needle in and see what's behind that facade of character, that front of character. There's depth. There are also questions.
Yes, indeed. And I think that's one of the, you know, we take the Bill of Rights seriously on this show. We take maximum advantage of it, and we speak candidly.
There are nights that just bring you to tears. It's not always hard news. It was only a couple of weeks ago that we sat in this studio with two members of a South African choir, the Sinikitemba Choir from Durban, South Africa, of all-female choir, all HIV positive choir in a country on a continent that is absolutely plagued by AIDS. I asked two members of the choir, their names they used with us were Priti and Namusa, to describe how men in their community in South Africa view the HIV-AIDS crisis.
I think men are not accepting of this disease. If you tell a man that you are HIV positive, maybe if a man is proposing to you and you say, I'm HIV positive, then the man will say, no, it's fine. If I get it from you, it's fine.
They honestly do. They say that.
Yes, they will say that, but it's because they don't believe that you can be pretty if you are HIV positive and you can be healthy. They think that they can save a person by being slim.
Musa, how do you feel about the fairness or equity of South African society when it comes to HIV and AIDS as a woman?
I can't be sure, but men are, most of them are denial, are living in denial. Well, when I tried to tell my boyfriend about my HIV status, he told me he doesn't know about anything about that because he hasn't got it. And men, knowing very well that they are, maybe mostly they are the cause, they are the ones who infect the women. Mm. But most of the time, we are getting the blame.
Priti and Namusa, both members of an all-HIV-positive South African women's choir in studio with us on Point just a couple of weeks ago. And Jack, again, this word privilege comes to mind. These women are going around the world talking about the desperate struggle of that continent, and it did feel like a privilege to sit here and receive their honesty, their candor, their trust, their openness.
Yes, and the shocking import of what they're saying. You know, they're suffering not just from AIDS, but from crushing patriarchy. And, you know, we have to say in candor that the South African government has a heavy moral burden for having put off year after year. I think they've finally begun to change, recognizing that HIV causes AIDS and recognizing that they could do things for people who are ill, that they could do things for especially for pregnant women. And for whatever reason, they did not do that, and they have a grave, it seems to me, moral accounting on their hands.
But it's for all of us to sit up and listen. We heard on that same night how the AIDS crisis and hunger in Africa are now deeply intertwined. You can't solve one without the other, and you can't have a continent in that kind of crisis without it affecting the world. We've got a lot more to talk about this year. Jack Beattie, please stand by. We'll be back to you in just a couple of minutes. I want to bring WBUR News Director Sam Fleming and Assistant Program Director Peter Laidotis back into our conversation. Peter, a lot of people are taking the time to call in tonight, and we thank you, each and every one, for doing that, for making pledges of support for On Point and for BUR. And this fundraiser is offering some great ways, I guess, for BUR to say thanks to those
it
people.
It is. It is. First, let me give you the phone number now. If you'd like to call and pledge, 1-800-909-9287, or if you're listening online, you can pledge at WBUR.org. What we have for your pledge of $365, that's just a dollar a day. We'll say thanks with the brand new limited On Point fleece jacket. It's in maroon. I don't know if you chose the color, Tom.
We haven't even seen them, but boy, it sounds great.
It sounds great. And as the show sounds great, too, help pledge and keep the show strong at 1-800-909-9287. Pledge that dollar a day, $365 pledge. We'll thank you with the On Point fleece jacket.
I hope people will stand up and do that. A dollar a day sounds like a reasonable amount. 365 is not a small number, but a dollar a day sounds reasonable for everything that comes across, not just here in the evening, but morning, noon, and night from NPR and WBUR. Well, I'm a listener, too, and it sounds good to me.
Well, it's what we pay for our New York Times, and on Sunday it costs us more than that. But I wanted to get back to the women you were just talking about. They are good examples, I think. If you read about AIDS in Africa in the newspaper, it's a statistic. It's meaningful. But when you hear their voices, when you hear what they have to say, and when you have a conversation with them, you realize that they're human beings just like the rest of us. They come from a place. They have families. They have communities. And it makes it all the more meaningful. It's the power of radio. And I think the conversations that On Point provides night after night brings out the power of human voices and the power of what's going on in the world.
And you can join the conversation now. now by calling 1-800-909-9287 and helping to pay for On Point with Tom Ashbrook. And remember, you know, we've tossed out dollar a day, $20 a month. Whatever you pledge is great. And if you pledge between now and 8 o'clock, your name will get entered into the drawing to win a correspondence tour at the Museum of Fine Arts with Tom Ashbrook. Tom, what's this all about?
Well, it's my little contribution. They asked me to cough up something. You know, I spent about 10 years in Asia, Peter, living in India, in Hong Kong, in Japan, traveling all over that country. It's kind of my second home. I know it like the back of my hand. And they said, well, why don't you take someone over to the Asian collection of the MFA, where it is a terrific collection, and give a correspondence tour, not that of a curator, not that of an art historian, but there are so many items in that collection that spark just incredible memories about real flesh and blood stories of Asia that I look forward to sharing with somebody.
I love I've heard you say that now three times today, the correspondence tour. Well, not a curator.
That's the one I'm qualified to give, but after 10 years, I can give quite a lot there.
Well, get in on the drawing by calling 1-800-909-9287. Pledge the amount that's right for you, and you and Tom may be taking a trip over to the MFA. And remember, your name, that's only until 8 o'clock now when you pledge. So 1-800-909-9287, just about 20 minutes left.
And I'll talk for a second about being a correspondent. Tom came to WBUR with lots of newspaper experience, for the most part, from places like Asia and living in Japan and Hong Kong and various other places, and brought that vast experience to this chair that he sits in every night with his staff, and grabbing the headlines and then figuring out who are the people that we need to talk to. He brings that experience to ask the kind of questions that need to be asked. That's something that you get every night here on Point.
And, you know, think about that information you do get every night. Think about that a correspondence tour over at the MFA. You're going to get that same kind of insight and information. It sounds like a terrific trip, frankly. You don't want to miss out on this. So make that pledge call now at 1-800-909-9287, and good luck on winning the correspondence tour with Tom.
I'm looking forward to it. I guess most of all, I'm just grateful to all of our listeners for making this possible. It's those contributions that put this show on the air that really build the venue, build the tent. We can pull in the biggest names. Bill Schneider, on the day that he talked to us about the midterm elections, he was in the airport in Atlanta. He took the time out on his cell phone to call in, give us that analysis. Why? Because he knows there's a great audience here and he'll have good questions. The women from South Africa, they come here because they know it's a humane venue. They'll be treated with respect. We'll really go to the heart of what they have to say.
And it is interesting, Tom. You've talked about the uniqueness of public radio call-in programs, and On Point being the one in the evening, perhaps the first in the country that we know about. And what the callers end up doing, and it's amazing the consistency with which they do it, is they all of a sudden take what has been a wonderful conversation and it leaps to another level. And I think it's because of the kind of callers we have. They're very smart, and it makes the conversation richer.
The callers help make the show. You also, with your call now, help make the show at 1-800-909-9287 with a pledge.
Peter, Sam, stand by. We'll come back to you later in the program. Now I want to bring Jack Beattie, our On Point news analyst, back in. Jack, we're sailing through some of the top news stories that were on Point this year. Of course, one of the biggest stories all year around the country, but especially here in Boston, involved the Catholic Church. We talked in August with Sister Joan Chittister. It's been a rough year for the Catholic Church. Joan Chittister is a Benedictine nun and church activist in Erie, Pennsylvania. She came on the show in August in the midst of all the debate and anguish about the clergy sex abuse, and talked about the importance of the church allowing an open debate on its practices.
Silencing is not good for the church. You've just seen it in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
When we keep, quote, in the family, for the sake of the image or the present definition of church, when we refuse discussion and openness, has this been good?
The breath of a priest on his neck who was raping him. I mean, my God, that's the kind of real stuff you get on our program, moving, authentic.
One of our great privileges here has been to work with Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent, who now is based in Kandahar, Afghanistan, working for an NGO there, a non-governmental organization, on civic issues in Afghanistan. Sarah has been good enough to ship us reports from Kandahar, where she's intimately involved with the community there, with society there, as it struggles with change. Sarah talked in this clip about how ordinary Afghans want American help, but oftentimes that help comes in the wrong form.
Ordinary, impoverished, struggling villagers in a province like Uruzgan have little interaction with American troops at all, and what they have is usually a battlefield view. And these same villagers have quite enough with their own local gunmen to contend with, thugs who can go in and take over a charity clinic because they have the firepower. An international security force, such as is deployed in Kabul, could help provide recourse against these gunmen, whose lawless, violent, and arbitrary behavior is exactly what led to the South, anyway, accepting the Taliban as a welcome respite. But instead of playing this protecting role, the U.S. troops here are reinforcing the gunmen and the local potentates they're loyal to by hiring them to help in the hunt for al-Qaeda. These are the wrong allies. They often give the wrong information, as they may have done in Darawat, and they prey upon the people, leaving them to come to people like me for help. Afghans are not hostile to a U.S. presence here in general. Indeed, they welcomed it from the start. But this kind of presence is destructive, and it is, slowly, making the Afghans I know here in the South angry.
Former NPR correspondent Sarah Chase, shipping her in her report there for On Point from Kandahar, Afghanistan. There, Jack, Sarah describes the United States forces in cahoots with the warlords, the wrong allies, to use her words, and the way in which that has been grating on the Afghan people we're supposed to be helping.
Yes, and often fatal for them. I believe she was reporting from the area where, partly because of poor intelligence and slanted intelligence from a warlord who was hostile to them, we bombed a wedding party and killed something like 50-odd people.
That's a heavy price to pay. Sarah's predicting there that this would gradually wear away on the Afghan welcome. Just this week we had Michael Ware of Time magazine on, who's just back from Afghanistan, talking about what's actually happening in this same region now with al-Qaeda bases in Pakistan, now sending terrorists across the border, firing missiles on U.S. troops in forward camps. Not a pretty picture, and Sarah predicted it in July.
Yes, and it may be that the future, what lies in store for us, is military action in Pakistan against those bases as the war might spread.
On Memorial Day in May, we took the time to listen to the U.S. troops who are carrying out all these missions in the field. We had some extraordinary stories from men and women all over the Middle East and around the world who are the ones on the front line, and more may be on the front line soon. In this clip, we talked with Naval Chaplain Ronald Craddock. During Operation Enduring Freedom, Ronald Craddock, that is last year's operation in Afghanistan, Ronald Craddock recorded the oral histories of his fellow chaplains and the spiritual challenges American troops face while on combat missions. Chaplain Craddock talks here about a particularly difficult question a sailor posed to his ship's chaplain.
He was making his round visiting with the different sailors when he came upon one of the sailors who was standing his watch over a 50 cal machine gun, and his watch required him to watch for any kind of small boats that might be coming near the ship. And as the chaplain walked up on the sailor turned to look at the chaplain. The chaplain said to him, "What are you doing? What's your job?" And he said, "Sir, my job is to watch for small boats that might be coming up alongside, and my orders are to kill anybody that was to come near the ship." And he looked back at the chaplain, and he paused for a minute, and he said, "Sir, if I have to kill somebody, will I go to hell?" Well, from the chaplain's perspective, what we want to do is to deal with what is going on in that person's mind. What brought you to that, and what caused you to feel that way, and where did you get that feeling and that instruction and that conviction that makes you feel that way? So what we do is we try to talk them through that and their feelings and to assure them that what they're doing certainly is a very tough job, but it's also a job that has to be done for the safety of those on the ship.
Naval Chaplain Ronald Craddock, and the question from the sailor, "If I have to kill, will I go to hell?" We try every night on this show to keep the urgent immediacy of these issues alive and in full view, because this is not some kind of cold seminar. These are life and death issues for Americans and for those they interact with overseas. I was really moved by that question from that young American sailor, Jack.
Yes, and it was just a year ago today that six Army personnel, Green Berets, and helicopter personnel were buried. They died in an accident. And I remember reading one of them. She was a woman from Chicago, from the poor part of Chicago. And her sister said of her that, "I had a good sister. She told me what was right." And when you put that against these corporations, when you put that against these churchmen, you see the real human measure, I think.
Well, and a measure that in all these venues, corporations and church included, is a path to hope. I mean, despite all the tough stories that we've had to cover this year, Jack, it's those simple virtues that people again and again come back to. We hear it in our callers, we hear it in our guests, we hear it in the people we speak to in the field. They give me hope that we're going to work through the problems as multifarious as they may be.
Yes, and it gives me hope just listening to callers who tell things or people we've had who've interviewed who tell of how they're coping with this and tell of what they're doing. And I think it, there's false hope, the rah, rah, rah kind, and then there's the unblinkered kind where you look at the odds and you said, well, by gosh, I'm still going to do my job.
The part that comes from the soul. On September 11th, everyone was remembering the anniversary. We were fortunate to have you, Jack, in New York for that week. You stood, along with thousands of other Americans, at Ground Zero for the memorial service held for the September 11th victims. It's an important anniversary. It's what kicked off the life of On Point, as well as a huge parade of events around this world that we're still dealing with. I want to listen back from New York to Jack Beatty sharing his thoughts on that day, September 11th, 1 year after the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center.
You know, it was hard to keep back tears, especially when we heard the names that they would come in. You know, there they were, the Rosenthals, the Rosenbergs, the Rosenblums, 10 Kellys, 6 Wongs, the
Viglianos,
the Vegas, the Browns, 10 Smiths, the city's patchwork fraternity. But for me, the day was sort of built around a man we met called David, who was a construction worker who came on the first day and spent the first 3 weeks of September right there. And he told us about his boots. He had to get 3 different pairs of boots because it was so hot it burned right through the soles. He told us about the dogs. 300 dogs were there, and the dogs would work for 18 hours at a time and still be trying to find. And to show what the guy was made of, there was a woman with a bag, and she had petals of flowers in the bag. And when the firemen would go by, she'd throw the petals of flowers at them. And she began to break up and cry, and out reached the hand of this construction worker and took her hand, the muscles tightening, and held it. And you thought, this is the kind of man that you build a world around.
10 Kellys, 6 Wongs, 10 Smiths. Jack, you took us right back to that site and reminded us of the human cost of that kind of tragedy, the cost and the consequences that motivate me, and I can tell you every night, to really dive into these issues, because this is not a joke. This is about human life in our country and around the world. It matters to dig in and really figure out what's going on here.
Yes, and to try in our journalistic way to measure up to people like that, like David, that construction worker, and to try in our little way to measure up to a woman like Cindy McGinty, whom we spoke to that week, who lost her husband and who was at New York, down in New York for the service. And she was debating that day, will I watch cartoons with the kids or will I take them to the ceremony? I don't know what she did. But I tell you, just meeting her and seeing her composure and her moral resolve and her heroic efforts to sort of make the best of it for her children, that was inspiring.
Jack, it's been great throughout this year having you along to dig into all of this with, and so many of these stories. I guess each and every one of them still has a long way to go. But I'm looking forward to jumping right back in the new year and hoping that we find silver lining in a lot of them and maybe some break in the clouds here. Jack Beatty, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's an honor and a pleasure to work with you.
Well, it's my pleasure and my honor. Thank you, Tom, and thanks to the station.
WBUR News Director Sam Fleming and Assistant Program Director Peter Lidotes are back in the studio with me. Peter, the hour's almost over, and I understand we're coming up on a deadline.
We are. We have been saying all day that everybody who calls today makes a pledge up until 8 o'clock tonight will be entered into a drawing to go over to the Museum of Fine Arts with Tom Ashbrook for a correspondence tour. We've got 8 minutes left.
Oh, I'm the deadline.
You're the deadline, Tom. So, you know, you're a fan of On Point. We're going to be giving away this drawing, giving away this tour with Tom. You're a fan of On Point. You don't want to miss out on this. It sounds like a terrific time. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call. Now, you don't have to make a pledge when you call, but remember, pledges from listeners like you are what keep On Point coming. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call. Don't miss out.
And remember that On Point comes at the end of the day. It's the icing on the cake, so to speak. All the news and information that you count on all day long, and then you get a rich conversation with On Point. This is a program that is probably important to you, especially if you're listening right now. Give us a call. Show your support for this kind of unique program that I can really say that you can't get anywhere else.
And please bear in mind all the work that goes into making this program possible. The staff of On Point that works like crazy day in and day out, week after week. This show was named the top news talk show in Boston, bar none, by the Associated Press for 2002. We're extraordinarily proud of that. I'm so proud of the team that makes that possible, but it's really you that make it possible with the contribution that keeps it going. 1-800-909-9287.
You've been meeting to pledge. Maybe you haven't had a chance. Now's your time. Make the pledge now. Get your name in on the drawing to go with Tom over to the MFA for the Correspondents' Tour. If you can go a dollar a day, that $365 pledge, we'll send you the On Point fleece jacket in a lovely maroon. The more we talk about it, Tom's cheeks start to turn that lovely shade of maroon. 1-800-909-9287.
You know, over the course of the year, Tom, it's amazing how often I've run into people, and I include myself in this, who have gone home in the past and kind of automatically perhaps turned on the television.
Zone out,
stop listening to the radio, I can't get any more information. And they say to me, this On Point, what's the story with this On Point? And I think that it's just one of those things that has spread, and you now make the program listeners like you because this is a program that is a rich conversation. It's like sitting around a dinner table every night and chewing over a very important issue. Give us a call right now. Show your support.
1-800-909-9287. Last chance if you want to get in on the drawing to win the Correspondents' Tour with Tom at the MFA. 1-800-909-9287. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and by Nortec, creating building products to help improve the comfort and security of homes and workplaces around the world, and Essex Partners, providing career advice, consulting services, and new opportunities to senior executives in transition in Boston and on the web at essexpartners.com. 1-800-909-9287 is the number to call to pledge your support.
It's 1-800-909-9287. You can also make a contribution to the website, wbur.org. It's really your outpouring of support for this show and the kind of frank talk and aggressive exploration that we go for here that's kept the show on the air, that's put it on the air in the first place. On Point is driven by the urgent issues that shape our world. We're committed to that daily, vigorous debate and analysis of what it all means. We don't pull punches. We don't expect you or our guests to either. We need your support now to keep that coming. 1-800-909-9287.
And it's interesting, Tom. We talked about how this program started several days after 9/11. We had a need for additional information at night. It's one of those programs that just took off. I think it was created in about 2 days, and it's just grown. And when you think about the kind of subject matter that you have traditionally looked at, you and Jack were just talking about this, almost all of those subjects now relate to the new world, the post-9/11 world. Even something like the corporate culture in America relates to that. It all plays into a better understanding of what's going on.
And it's what you're helping to pay for. 1-800-909-9287. If you're a fan of the show, get in there now on that drawing. 1-800-909-9287. What's coming up in hour two?
Hour two, we've got a terrific panel of people who have faced unemployment and faced it for a long time. We've got a lot of unemployment right now, but of course it can be heaviest in some of the high-tech areas. We're going to talk about what it's like to live month after month without that job. It's that kind of information that creates compassion, that creates understanding, that leads to that kind of problem being fixed. From the very beginning, we've said, what's On Point about? Well, On Point in ballet, On Point is up on your toes. In war, it's the lead soldier on patrol. In conversation, it's the heart of the matter. That's where we intend to be this hour, every hour. With your help, we'll be there at 1-800-909-9287.
And it's funny, I think about the dinner conversation that we talked about, but I forgot that we also have these debriefs before the dinner conversation starts. And it's almost like, well, we're going to call our friend and find out what's going on.